This is the Lean Construction Blogs podcast, a podcast dedicated to stories, case studies, and lessons learned of applying lean construction from around the world. Join Dick Beyer as he interviews industry leaders, lean construction practitioners, and subject matter experts to help you improve the built environment in general and your design and construction projects in particular. Advance your lean journey and bring your continuous improvement efforts to the next level. Let's get started.
Good afternoon, everybody, or good day, or good evening, wherever you may be in the podcast world. I'm Dick Beyer, and this is the Lean Construction Blog podcast. I want to thank all of our listeners out there. It's been remarkable that we have over 15,000 downloads of the podcast and more than 7,000 on YouTube. So thank you for doing that and keeping up with it. You're going to love our guest today because I love this kid. Everybody's a kid to me, so. Despite how professionally developed you are, you're still just a kid to me. So let me introduce you to Andreas Phelps, Dr. Andreas Phelps, who lives somewhere outside of the universe in California. And Andreas and I have been buddies since, I don't know, maybe the last 15 or 20 years. I did a lot of work at some point in time with Balfour Beatty. And Andreas is one of those Penn State PhDs like Mark Concher and Bevan Mace and others that came out of the Victor Sanvito program or what followed the Victor Sanvito program. And he has a PhD in construction management. And now he's out there running an operation called the Collective Enterprise, I think. So without further ado, Andreas, welcome to the podcast.
All right. Thanks, Dick.
Good to be here.
I'm looking forward to this. Yeah, you're one of the most well-read people that I know, so I'm looking forward to this discussion.
That's trouble. And that's when people always call me on it. And I said, no, was that really that book? But I do think reading is what expands your mind. It's so hard in the world to deal with metaphor if you haven't been exposed to it on a regular basis. So welcome. So tell us a little bit about... we were in New Orleans a couple of weeks ago, and you were the keynote speaker. You kicked off the Lean Construction Institute to a crowd of about 4.5 million people. Probably seemed like that when you're looking out over their heads. But I just wanted to—I wanted to introduce you in a different way, in the way that how you grew up, where you're from. I know you've got some connections with the Greek Isles, so tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Where to start? So my mother came over here from Greece after high school, and my father is, like, I don't know, 12th generation New Englander, right? So that's the mix that comes in. But I think what's interesting about that is and you know, there's been research about this, about I think they call them, like, third culture kids, when you kind of grow up and you've got two forms of reality that you've got to reconcile into your own creative interpretation of the world, right? And so I've got kind of the old world, you know, Greek culture, which is very different from the, you know, the Protestant New England influence. And so growing up in that, you know, you've got to kind of pay attention to it all and hold on to the parts of that resonate with you. And let go of some of the things that maybe don't work. So that, you know, a lot of that was my experience growing up, of just being influenced by all these different factors, different ways of living, and, you know, different value sets and stuff like that. And then trying to find my own path with it, you know, as I got older. And so we were in Boston for, till I was about 11, and then moved to Hershey, Pennsylvania, where the Penn State Medical Center is. And that's where my parents are. They've just retired recently. So they were there for a number of years. And then I went to Penn State, as you mentioned, for undergrad, which I focused really on structural engineering, but always had a passion for sustainability, because it was kind of like this notion of trying to understand how things really behave, how they really interact with, you know, these natural forces, and trying to figure out, can we design in a way that is in harmony or at least works with those natural processes rather than trying to control them, you know, and
right.
And over, you know, overpower them. Right. And so even though I was looking at structural engineering, my I was there for bachelor's and master's initially. My thesis was looking at, you know, the inherent structural capacity of certain types of connections that we just assume have no value. Right. And trying to see, is there a way that we can have a deeper understanding of what's really going on and then use that understanding to just design smarter, design something that's a little more of a harmonious approach to it. Right.
Yeah, that's very cool. I've always, I saw an article, I don't know, 10 years ago about how the Dutch are building houses that float rather than building more dikes, because dikes just don't work. I mean, the water eventually rises. And as we saw, you know, in New Orleans 10, 12 years ago, the fact that you can make a civil structure doesn't make the civil structure the right option.
Right. Yeah. So then after, you know, after my master's, I was out here in California in San Francisco working for an engineering consulting firm called Simpson, Gumperz & Hager. And that was really just a fascinating time for me, because what they did, I was focused on building envelope systems. So that line between the inside and the outside, that's got to handle all kinds of stuff. It's got to transfer loads to the structure. It's got to manage thermal. It's got to manage light transmission. It's got to manage, you know, all the UV degradation and air and moisture and all that sort of stuff. And so that was fascinating to me, that you're just dealing with all these things and how they come together in a single system. But the other thing that was fascinating to me is, even though I was, you know, immersed in the science of how these things work, I had to help architects figure out, how do all these systems come together? How do we design the interfaces, like where the curtain wall system runs into the roof, runs into the below grade, and how does all that stuff work together? So there's a lot of that integrated design that needed to happen. And then the third part of that was the construction administration. You can have the best design, the best theoretical design in the world. If the guy can't get his hand behind there to make the lap, it's not a good design. Right? Yeah. So it was a lot of construction administration. And then the last part that kind of brought it all together was the failures investigations. Something went wrong. Something didn't perform the way that we wanted it to. Was it a failure in understanding the science? Was it a failure in design? Was it a failure regarding means and methods and the human factors? And then learning from that so that we can do that whole process better. And so I spent a number of years there and just loved that work and loved just that systems thinking that really had to develop from doing that type of work. There was one thing, though, that always bothered me. And that was, you know, here I am, a subject matter expert, just like many other people in our field. And, you know, there'd be an issue. And a bunch of us get together and we talk about it and we try to figure out how to fix it. And so I know what I know. Like, I have all the knowledge, I have my experiences, I'm articulating whatever I can possibly articulate that I think is relevant. And in some cases, that would translate into significant value. Like, we'd come up with great solutions and solve the problem. And in other cases, it was just noise. Like, I felt like I said all this stuff and it just fell flat. Like, no one picked it up. No one understood the significance of it. And I'm like, if this is happening to me, it must be happening to everybody else. Right. And so I was just fascinated by this idea of what happens when we as individuals, with all of our technical knowledge, our experiential knowledge, our perspectives on how we see a situation or the world, when we get together, what are those factors that help us create something that's greater than the sum of the parts, or that result in something that's much less than the sum of the parts? And so I went back to Penn State then, and that's when I got, that was the focus of my doctoral work, is just looking at what are the tools, what are the processes, what are the behaviors that allow us to really reap the benefit of true integration in our project teams. And that's also where I got introduced more formally to all the lean, the entire lean framework and concepts and philosophy. And I was looking at, you know, just on, there were two healthcare projects, a children's hospital and a cancer institute that were at different phases. And, you know, I like to describe it as like, I was Jane Goodall in the jungle, except, you know, I was in the construction trailer, and I won't say who the chimps and the apes were, you know, the gorillas, but anyway, observing them and just watching, like, what's going on? Like, we just had a meeting. 10 of us were in this meeting and we talked about all these things, and I've got all the notes of everything that was said. And then I go and ask somebody 5 minutes later, and there's a 20-minute section of that meeting that they totally have no recollection about. Or there was a decision that we made that they think it was one way and someone else thought it was another. And that was right after the meeting, let alone what happens a week later or a month, right? And so I just saw Lean as this great framework, this great reservoir of tools, techniques, behaviors, to really help us with that problem, to help us figure out how to really get the most out of what we're doing. And so, yeah.
What's funny is that your background, those four things that amazed you about, you know, working in the world that drove you back to Penn State are much of what drives people into the lean world. Todd Zabel has this wonderful graphic that the buildings leak at the intersection of contracts. Right. And it is really that siloed piece that you wonder, how is it that we ever even build a building if people don't understand building as a system and as a system that needs to work? And as you go into the trailer, or you go into a room, or you go into a design studio, and you see the disparate parts moving, you know, running very fast, but running kind of away from each other, you wonder, wow, there's got to be a way to get this thing organized so that we're all on the same page here. So I'm interested that was your, you know, a keystone in the Keystone State, by the way, to getting you back to Penn State.
Well, just to build on what you're saying, it's amazing. You know, every other high performing team that I can think of, sports teams, you know, musical ensembles, whatever, they practice. They know each other so well. They know when I throw the ball there, that guy's, he's not there right now, but he's going to be there in 5 seconds when that ball gets there.
Right.
Construction. I mean, you had this great analogy. I wish I could remember it about, you know, like if we played the orchestra the same way as we built our project. Do you remember that, Dick?
Oh yeah. Yeah. We go out and we hire orchestras, right? One piece at a time. But if we, in fact, if the orchestra played like we do construction projects, the tuba player would be running off halfway through. The violinist would just be in a funk. The conductor would be missing pages. I mean, think about trying to conduct Mozart from a P6 schedule. You're on page 22, and then you go to page 66, and then you go to page 37, and then where am I going now? And everybody's going, oh. Yeah, it's ridiculous that we don't orchestrate what we do, that there isn't a conductor that everybody goes, this is the organizing force that we need to help us move through it. And I've always thought, especially in the lean world, you know, this always makes my friends crazy. The least valuable people on the project are the GCs, unless, because they don't install any work. I mean, there's not a single screw that gets turned by those guys, except maybe they pour a small slab for a temporary power thing, or they put in a ball year to make sure somebody doesn't back up on something. But in general, they don't do any, you know, actual installation. But the conductor of an orchestra doesn't play an instrument either, and yet brings extraordinary value by orchestrating all of those different disparate parts to come together in a single piece. I was just in Toronto last week and saw Carmen, the opera by Bizet. Mm-hmm. And just, you can't do an opera unless everybody's on the same page. And this was a cast of like 400 people and stuff. It was amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. So if we go from graduate school, then I did go back to SGH for a couple of years. And with the insight that I had from my doctoral work, I tried doing things differently. Right. And so one thing that I noticed is in the consulting world, in engineering consulting world, we often get graded by how well we can put the fire out, right? Like there's a problem on site. We go back to the office. We come out with the sketch. We're like, I got the sketch. We can resume work now, right? Because everything had to stop. And we also get graded on how many problems we can find with things that are going on in the field. Like, we do this field report. We go out there once every 3 or 4 weeks. We write this big, long field report of all the things that we saw that need to be corrected. And that makes us feel good. Like, we're doing our job. Like, we found these problems, right? And so I tried to switch that around. And I said, and I looked at it. I'm like, you know, I'm going out to these sites. I'm spending 4 hours there, an hour just trying to figure out what's going on. Another hour kind of like, you know, trying to get the trades that I'm reviewing their work to come out of the cracks and talk to me, right? Because they know I'm just there to screw them.
Yeah.
And then finally, like, you know, seeing some stuff, taking some pictures, trying to like figure out, like, you know, is any of this urgent? And I said, let me switch this around. For the same budget, I could do much shorter but more frequent visits. And I could be out there twice a week. And just, you know, I don't need to figure out what's going on because I was just there a couple of days ago. I also see these guys over and over and over again. So I start developing a rapport with them. I start talking to them and they, you know, and they're sharing their concerns of like, yeah, you know, we're supposed to be here next week, but I don't see how that's going to be. Okay. All right. Let's talk about that. Or there's this detail that's really difficult for them to install. So let's talk about it. Right. And so that dynamic, just like we try in IPD, that dynamic of being on the same team, really, like, you know, I'm a supporting character, not an adversarial character, right? Just changed the dynamic. And the field reports got so much shorter because there wasn't much to talk about. So it took me 15 minutes instead of 4 hours to put together a field report. And I never had to like stop work because there was something so urgent that, you know, like, we can't proceed until this gets figured out. And, you know, the interesting thing was, my boss said, he's like, I don't know how your projects are going because you're never coming into me with these issues. I said, well, isn't that a good thing?
Yeah. Right?
So anyway, I was trying this different approach again, just from a lean perspective. How do I add more value? The other thing I was doing more of at that point was some organizational best practices. So that company had grown from two offices and about, I think, 250 people to six offices and 450 people. And they were starting to get like regional differences in their approach to different things. And so started doing some basic process mapping and sharing those, you know, with the different offices and getting their, you know, getting them to review it and learn from what I had already aggregated from some of the offices, and then also adding, you know, their best practices onto there. And so I was doing more and more of that work. And then the opportunity came up to go to Balfour Beatty, where they had acquired a bunch of companies at that point in time. And they needed help integrating those companies into, you know, one national brand, so to speak. And so specifically, you know, my role was around some of these best practices around lean, integrated project delivery, even, you know, getting into the BIM and the visualization. And that's where you and I, you know, I had the good fortune of being able to work with you, Dick. And I really, you know, looked fondly upon that time. You know, the other thing that I would say, a lot of times when I look back at sort of these phases in life, it's not so much the role that I have or the things that I did, but it's what did I learn, right? And at Balfour, that's where I learned, you know, you can have an idea that you know a good idea. You know it's valuable, right? And you can try to talk to people about it, but they're busy people. They have lots of stuff that they have to do, you know, and so how do you make it compelling enough that they want to change? And a big lesson that I learned there was you can't make it too easy. Because if you make it too easy, it's transactional. You know, it's a commodity. And you actually do it, you do that, what I thought were profound ideas, you do them a disservice because you've actually made it too easy for the person just to kind of like pick it up and throw it into the project. And they don't realize the significance of what they're doing. Right. And so, you know, so it was a lot of fun working with those Balfour teams, with the different organizations, client organizations that were really trying to move the needle in terms of what they were doing. Just a fascinating time. But as you know, I mean, life has its own plan for us, right? And so I was starting a young family, and I wanted to be around more. I didn't want to be flying, you know, all over the place and at a last minute's notice. And so I started my own consulting company, The Collective Potential, and I've been working with GCs and owners to help them through lean adoption, but really actually just any sort of organizational transformation.
And yeah, so that's what it seems to me from your keynote. I mean, we were both working with Balfour when it was Balfour and it was Barnard and it was Howard K. Smith or whoever it was up in Portland. And then there were
the, oh, that's right. Yeah.
Then there were the Howard K. Smith reporting live from London. And then there were the English folks, and then there was the entire Florida contingent that was different. It was amazing to see the way the cultures had developed in each of those companies. And people talk about culture all the time, and I don't think that they really understand that it's really a deep concept. It's not, you know, somebody, I think Rex says, culture is what you do when you're all by yourself. Well, there's all kinds of things you do when you're all by yourself that don't have much to do with culture. I think that's more about trust, that you need to be able to trust people when they're all by themselves to do the right thing. Yeah. That's not necessarily culture, because there are cultures that have promoted people to do the wrong thing, and they're still cultures. So it's not just you develop a culture, you have to develop the right culture, right? And that is based on things that you believe deeply, and you believe them so deeply that you think you should teach them to others. And so I think when we look at cultures in our business, there's a lot of superficiality to that, that is based around camaraderie and collegiality, but not really deeply understanding how motivating the culture is, not understanding how important the language is, the language that expresses the beliefs. And so I think one of the things that you've been able to do is you've really been able to take those threads of what we have been trying to talk about, that each of these companies, and it's in the design world as well, and in the consulting world, it's not just construction. I don't want the construction guys to feel bad about it. It's in the owner organizations that we deal with. It's in every kind of organization, that culture has to be an integrated system, just like a building project has to be an integrated system. Yeah. And I think you have done an amazing amount of work to be thinking about the integration of those pieces. I mean, I look at your yurt in the background and the honeycomb unfolding envelope. I guess that thing expands and then you put the tent around it or whatever, right? Which is kind of cool.
Yeah. It's fast. That's another story. But yeah, that's fascinating.
But there are so many things that we see in the physical world and in our own lives and bodies that we just reject. We forget, you know, whoever invented the human, whatever your view of that kind of metaphoric development by some master genius or whatever, they didn't start with the face and the hair, you know, and what you look like, right? They had to have your body is a result of having to have containment for systems that are actually going to drive that body around and make it work on a regular basis. And we build so many buildings that don't work because we don't start thinking about it from the inside. Yeah. And yet everything that we see in nature starts with a system that, whether it's photosynthesis or it's the leaves turning brown and falling off the trees, everything is a system that works to propel the success of that organism. And so I applaud you for that work in that. And I want to kind of get into that.
Yes. Well, I mean, let's talk about culture just a little bit. I think my perspective on it, and, you know, of course, I'm influenced by all the things that I read and that I've sat with and I've, you know, struggled with and stuff like that. But I guess the way that I like to think about culture is it is what provides, like when you get immersed into a certain culture, whether it's an organizational culture or societal or whatever, it is a series of things that frame your perspective. So how you see the world, how you understand, you know, your role in that world, how you understand how your actions influence that world, and what you see your purpose in that world, right? And so in an organization, I think those are the things. It's not the marketing stuff. That's not culture. That's the marketing function, right? That's how do we communicate? How do we try to effectively communicate what we're doing to the outside world? It's like you were saying, you know, or I guess you said Rex said it, what you're doing when no one's looking, or what you're doing. And I don't even think it's that. It's even just what you're thinking, how you see your role. I mean, there was that quote that I shared at the keynote, you know, from the Bhagavad Gita, you know, millennia ago, of it starts with the perceptions on the mind. And from those perceptions, those start to influence our thoughts. And those thoughts start to influence our words. We start talking about the things that we're thinking about. And we start interacting with people in a certain way, and our actions then reflect those thoughts. And those actions over a period of time create our habits and our character and our destiny. And our character, that's at the individual level, but I think that, you know, at an organizational level, that's the culture. When you're talking about a group of people, the character that has emerged from that, I think that's the culture, right? And
well, and it, as you know, as you said, it has its own ethos. And if the culture hasn't developed correctly, if that's a, I mean, that's a pretty loaded term, a lot to unpack. And
how about intentionally? If it's not
intentionally,
yeah.
I mean, if it hasn't been thought of as a system that has to work, you know, in all of its pieces and parts, you end up getting, and this gets right into what you had talked about at the keynote. So at the keynote, you talk about the hero and the hero's journey and the Joseph Campbell hero stuff. And yet in our industry, to be a hero has been to ride in and kind of save the day, you know, and Joseph Campbell's got this great quote about heroes that they're necessary. I guess this is Rollo May. Heroes are necessary in order to enable the citizens to find their own ideals, courage, and wisdom. In the society, the hero carries our hopes, our aspirations, our ideals, our beliefs. In the deepest sense, the hero is created by us. He or she is born collectively as our own myth. And in construction, the hero, the person that's rewarded, is the person that rides in and saves a project, not the person who saw at the beginning. Your story reminds me of Kian's Andy's story, where he worked so hard to finish a project and he got it done, and he was 73 days without a time off. And he got a big bonus, and the owner of the company called him and said, well done. And the next one, he said, well, this is kind of silly. I don't want to do that this time. So on a much more difficult project, he got it brought in, you know, on time and on budget, and never heard from anybody. So the hero that culture creates, in fact, carries our aspirations and our hopes and our ideals and our beliefs, and they're all wrong. It's the wrong thing to promote, right? At least in my view.
Yeah. So let's talk about that a little bit, because I don't know. I mean, I think it's hero, champion, whatever, you know, whatever word you want to use. I think it's a little bit of a distortion of maybe what I want that word to mean, right? Like, it's not necessarily the winner. The champion's not the winner. Like, I win, like I figured it out, right? That's a very egocentric kind of way of thinking about it. A champion is a fighter for some noble cause, right? And so what are we fighting for? Are we fighting for awarding the individuals who have solved problems that shouldn't have been there in the first place? I mean, is that the noble cause that we're, you know, that we're fighting for, that the heroes are fighting for? Or is it that we're all in this mess together? I mean, you look at project teams, they are essentially your extended family for a number of years. You spend more time with them than you do with your own family.
Right, for sure.
And so how do we make that something that's enjoyable, that's transformative, that's inspiring, that, you know, is worthwhile, rather than some slog that gives us a paycheck that then we can, you know, use it for who knows what, right?
Right.
And so, you know, so again, I think this notion of a hero, there has to be some value that they're striving for. There has to be some noble cause that they are defending, or that they're in, you know, that they're that their life is in service of, right? And I think that's the part that's missing, Dick, is that we're not intentional about what is that noble cause. And it could be different for each of us, right? But there's a lot of similarities. Usually it has to do with connection, making the world a better place, making a better place for our kids, or setting an example. I mean, I do these lean leadership things with mostly senior leadership of organizations. Right. And those prime motivations, when we really get down to them, they're not that different. Most people, right. Yeah, most people, it boils down to a couple pretty simple things that are really, truly most important to them.
But what's funny, I mean, what strikes me is as the challenge here is that most of what you are called upon to do that is, quote, heroic inside of an organization is not necessarily a noble cause. It's not necessarily intentional. It is something that's been created by a misapprehension of where your goals and values really are, whether it's billing, you know, whether it's lawyers billing 3,000 hours a year on Wall Street so they can become partners. Well, nobody can actually bill 3,000 hours in a year. Trust me. So we're encouraging people to just make stuff up because that's the mark by which they're seen. And we misplace that as heroism, right? Because we don't have an organizational center that people aspire to. And if you just think about how our industry has developed with bilateral contracts, it's like UFC, right? In UFC, there's two guys in a cage that just pummel each other to death until one of them actually dies or gets close to death, and then they pull the other guy off. And the guy that has pummeled him to death is the hero. And bilateral contracts are like that. So people don't think about it. You know, I think about this from a lawyer philosopher's perspective, that if you put people in, and let's say we have 40 of those contracts on a construction project, that's 40 UFC fights. And somebody's going to win each one of those little battles, right? Like the electrician's kind of maybe prevail over the GC, but the GC will prevail over the mechanic. I mean, we're just in there fighting for that stuff. And people think that that's like an organizational system that works. And you go, how could that possibly be an organizational system that works when it just creates so much animosity and only two or three winners, you know, at the end of the day? It's like gladiators. At the end of the season, I guess there's only one gladiator left, and I don't know what they do with that guy.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, it always comes back to where are you drawing your circle? Like who's your I in that case, right? Is it me? Is it like I'm trying to win? Is it my team's trying to win? Is it the whole project's trying to win? Because you would behave differently depending on how you define that, right?
Right.
Like even your UFC or your, UFC analogy, it's like if they were actually trying to create the strongest like fighting squad that there ever was, you know, like think back to the old days of hand-to-hand combat, like that elite squad of like, you know, of warriors. About
300.
Yeah.
300 Spartans that held the gates of the Peloponnese against
the Persians. If that was your goal, you'd actually be doing it differently, right? Like you'd approach that whole process differently. Doesn't mean you wouldn't spar, doesn't mean you wouldn't practice, but you're not trying to beat the crap out of the guy so that he, you know, is
so he's near death,
never comes back and is, you know, weaker because of it. You're trying to do it in a more uplifting way. Still, doesn't mean you can't be the expert. Doesn't mean you can't be the subject matter expert, that ideal that people are striving towards, but you're doing it instead of putting so much of that energy to try to keep everybody else down, you're switching that and you're bringing them up. Right. And so I don't know. I mean, you have a lot more perspective on our industry than I do. But that's the ticket, right? It's like, how do we frame this in a bigger context? How do the GCs realize that if I help all my trade partners become stronger, it's actually going to help me. It also helped my competitors, but when my competitors are bringing their best game, that also forces me to be better, right? And it's like...
Used to say that the secret to the LCI Congress is the people who presented there understood that it was more valuable to share than to keep the secret sauce at home. That they could learn so much more by sharing what they did on projects, even at the expense of somebody else picking up some good ideas from them, but they could get it out there in the public, you know, in the agora, in the public forum, and they could have a conversation around it. And then they would improve from that.
Yeah. I mean, that used to and probably still does get me in trouble, where I have said to people, I've said, look, let's share it. Let's share it. If we can't leverage it, I mean, we're the ones who experienced it firsthand, right? If we can't leverage it more than the others, then shame on us, right? But right. We shouldn't not share it for the benefit of society just because we're scared somebody might actually take it and run with it. Like, that's our responsibility, right?
at the heart of my five principles, and these are kind of my five principles, I keep calling them the five lean principles, but I made them up. And so I guess I have to own them. But you know, everything starts with transparency and visibility. You know, you can't collaborate with somebody if you have a hidden agenda. You know, it just doesn't work. You can't be trying to get somebody to do something for your advantage without telling them what that advantage is. So collaboration is where we start building trust, right? You collaborate with people, you say you're going to do something, you do it, you know, time after time, and people go, oh, well, it's relatively trustworthy. And trust allows you to make commitments. So we tend to start with commitments. We want people to make a commitment, but they don't trust that everybody else around them. I mean, in a construction trailer, I make a commitment to hang ductwork. I am so dependent on 15 other trades to allow me to do that. And they're dependent on me to have work released from the fact that I'm hanging the ductwork. And yet I don't even know these people. We're on a project now in Hamilton where I tried to get everybody to share one trailer. But the unions in Canada have negotiated that every trade gets their own lunchroom, trailer, and the rest of that stuff. And I'm going, okay, we're spending, you know, $8,000 a month on trailers when we could just have one trailer. And it's in all our best interest to just eat together. I mean, what a concept. And it's like, oh, no, I'm not going to eat with an electrician. Are you kidding me? Those guys, have you ever met an electrician? it just seems, so this is really what I wanted to dig in. That's what I was so excited about doing this podcast. I want to dig into structurally, we're kind of broken, right? For all kinds of reasons. We just put aside what all those reasons are. How do we become, as an industry, and starting inside of a company, or starting inside of a department in a company, or starting inside of a crew, you know, a four-person crew that hangs ductwork, how do we begin to become intentional about believing the good stuff, having the values that are noble, that are, you know, allow you to be, I used to think of lean construction as the full employment act for soccer coaches, because the stuff that it takes us 80 hours to do, if we could do that in 40 hours, everybody could go home with their kids and go to their soccer games or be their coaches. And, you know, why not? For some reason, we keep sticking with this structural inadequacy in my mind that doesn't allow us to be intentional about all the right things. So how do we do that? Guru Phelps.
Yeah. You know, when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right? So right. I'm going to hit this from my perspective. If we're waiting for the opportunity in our project team or in our organization to do something, we're really limiting ourselves, I think, right? And like you're right. Waiting for that IPD project, or you're waiting for a superintendent who's willing to do last planner or whatever, you know, like it's really self-defeating, actually. And because you're bartering away your own potential for change, personal potential for change, and you're making it dependent on other people being okay with it. And so what I've been, you know, I mean, personally going through over the last couple of years, and then also in these, you know, in these sessions that I have with individuals, we start with you. We start with you, the person. I mean, Gandhi said it famously, you know, be the change you want to see in the world, right? Right. And it's like, don't wait to be able to change the world and then you can embody it, right? Like, do it the other way around. And so, you know, if you've got a crew of four, you figure out better ways to do the part of the work that you have to do. And you just do that relentlessly. And you refocus and you think a little bit about, okay, well, so what's the value that I'm really trying to create here? And is there a better way to do it? There are four questions that I just, I mean, I told this to one of my clients. I said, if you really want like the organization to change, to be more lean, to be better integrated, there's just four simple questions that we just got to ask all the time of everybody at every opportunity that we can. And it's, what's most meaningful about my work? What's getting in the way of me doing more of that? And then what's one thing that I can just try to do and see if that will, like, you know, change it?
Yeah.
And then try that. And then the fourth question is the reflective one of like, okay, what did I learn? Even if it didn't work out, what did I learn from it? Right. Switching that narrative of, okay, something went wrong. Who's to blame? No. Something went wrong. What can we learn from it? Right.
Yep.
And so those four questions, like, we can do that as an individual. You can do that all the time. You can do that with all your relationships, your kids, your spouses, your family, you know, your parents, your brothers and sisters, your, you know, best friends, whatever it is. You can ask those questions and play around in an area that you've got 100% agency, actually. Like, you can control how you show up and what you're trying to do in those relationships. You can't control their part of it, the other person's part of it, but you can control your part. And so I don't know. I mean, I've been at this a lot less, not as long as you have, Dick, but I don't know that there's an external remedy to that. I think it actually needs to come internally. And then when you're doing that, when that's part of your character, when that's part of how you engage with the world, other people see it and it's palpable. Like, they get it. I mean, and I see this again with just some of these folks that I've been working with one-on-one. We talk, you know, we go through these sessions for a number of weeks. They start having these conversations with people. Those other people are getting excited about the same thing because they're seeing their leader actually live it. You know, they're seeing the difference in the conversations that they're having with that person, the way that that person's trying to do things themselves differently.
Right.
And that's actually what's infectious, right? That's what good infection in this case, right?
penicillin is a good infection, right? Because it does something that it's better than otherwise would do, right? Yeah. So there are things that we just tend to be, that's not going to work. It's funny because just yesterday I was kicking off a project in Toronto, and I like to kick it off with a love and loathe session. So you get people organized in groups of three, because that's the largest brainstorm unit you can have without somebody taking control. And it's the smallest one you can have that includes all voices. So I really believe in the three-person brainstorming thing. And we just brainstormed, what do you love about design and construction? And you come up with, you know, it's always very much the same stuff. And then you say, well, what do you loathe about it? What do you hate about it? And so it's very much about, you know, so what's my best self when I'm on a construction project? What do I really love about being here? What is what's the thing that I do that contributes the most? And then the stuff that I hate is the stuff that gets in my way, right? It keeps me from being my best self. And it's also funny that most of what we love is aspirational. Collaboration, good friends, good team, great project, happy client. All those things. The things we hate are RFIs and change orders and, you know, unrealistic budgets and unrealistic schedules. And we can do something about those because they're just systematic or they're systemic. We can change the system so we don't actually have those, you know? And that's, I think, what IPD tries to do is try to change the system so that you don't run into those things. But very much like what you said, it's at that point then, and below all that. So I have my five, you know, goals or values or whatever that I see. And then under all of that is knowledge. You're constantly learning something. So why do we just keep doing this stuff that we've always done when we know it's just not right?
We're too busy. We're too busy.
We are.
You know,
have you seen that cartoon where the guys they have the square wheels on the car? And they say, we got work to do. We don't have time to innovate. You guys sitting there with the round.
It's fascinating to me that this happens. I mean, maybe it happens more in our industry than others. I don't know. But we don't have time to think about how to do it better, but we have time to do it two and three times over. Right. And it's right. Like, and there's some, there must be some psychological thing there where it's like, I'm under such stress that I can only see this immediate moment right now. And I can't possibly, you know, wrap my head around a bigger picture. And so right now in this microsecond of what matters right now, it's me getting this task done the way that I already know how to do it. I don't have to think extra. I don't have to exert any extra energy or brain power to be able to do that. And it's a trap because you just end up running on the wheel faster, but it's not going anywhere, you know?
Yeah. And
so I, you know, I'm thinking of two different things here, Dick. One is,
well, this is perfect because that's kind of your mantra, right? Is that contradictions are the things that build the brass in all of us.
Yeah. Well, that's I don't know. You can fact check me, but I think Niels Bohr, like their lab where they were doing all the nuclear fission experiments or whatever, it's like on the door of the lab, it says, where there's paradox, there's progress, right? Like where we come up against something that we can't reconcile the two things, that's where there's potential. Like that's where there's progress. And I mean, even on the psychology side, you know, I mean, I was on the Jungian side, they say being able to hold the tension of opposites is where that third option finally emerges, right? But right, you got to hold the tension for long enough. And maybe that's what we don't do. We don't.
Well, one of the things I think the way we express it in our community is it's the and conversation, right? When things appear to be contradictory, how do you, so you talk about loneliness on the one hand and faith on the other hand, right? But it's really loneliness and faith because they go together, as paradoxical as that may seem, that your loneliness starts to disappear if you have faith that it's just not going to be there, right? Or if you have faith that something will come down the line. I mean, that one of the great, since I had to pull these things up for our little chat today, Joseph Campbell, who's I know one of your friends, that we have to be willing to let go of the life we planned so that we can get to the life that's waiting for us.
Oh yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, that's such a profound thing. I mean, if you actually sit with it, it's like, if everything in my life had gone the way that I planned it to go, man, it would have been boring.
It would have been terrible.
And so it's like, I mean, it might have been easy, but you know, but yeah, in that desire for control, in that, you know, that tight fist around it of like, you know, I want it to go this way because that would be the easiest thing for me. We're also squeezing out the potential for life, you know, for just engaging with life and in a meaningful way. And again, I mean, you know, I've said this, I think I said this in the talk and I've said this to a number of people. When I look back, some of the most profound moments of my life have been the ones that definitely did not go the way I wanted them to go. And you know, and this is something even a mentor of mine, you know, had to remind me numerous times. He's like, don't wish those things away. He's like, these are your opportunities to come up against the limits of who you thought you were and realize who you are actually destined to be, right?
I stumbled across Steve Jobs's graduation speech, convocation speech for Stanford University a few years ago. Where all of these things, you know, when he got fired from Apple, that was the best thing that ever happened to him. Hard to imagine at the time. Hard to have the humility and the persistence that you talk about to be able to like go forward. But it was the greatest thing that ever happened to him because he had to dig deeper. He had to go further. It just wasn't simple. And Joseph Campbell also says, I love this one. If the path is clear to you, you're probably on somebody else's path.
Yeah. And so, I mean, but think about it, like how many, I was about to go into a Bob Dylan song.
Rose was the man.
How many roads are already well-worn and scripted out there? I mean, you know, you look at our whole system of education. It's like you pick a major, you go through some coursework, you know, you have a job, there's a promotion, you know, ladder that you got to work through. There's, you know, lists of competencies and all this sort of stuff. It's like, it's really actually quite hard to carve your own path. I mean, there's a lot of people that have done it,
but
they struggle with it. You know, I mean, it goes back to what you were saying, that tension between loneliness and faith. It's like, if you have enough of that self-awareness of like, no, this is actually what I feel like I'm meant to do. This is what I'm meant to manifest in the world. And I don't see a path I can go on this path for a little while because it serves me in developing certain skills. And then I might have to switch and go in a very different direction to, you know, so we kind of cobble together our own path. But it's something, you know, again, you look at some of these, one of my hobbies is trying to understand, you know, of all these things that have been thought about in the millennia that precede us. Are there some things that are universal? Are there some things that are timeless? And there is this, you know, there was this concept probably in a number of cultures, but the one that I happen to be exposed to was just out of India, where they talk about four phases of life. The first 24 years is about getting clarity on your purpose. The next 24 years is about acquiring all the resources, the skills, the relationships, whatever you need to do to be able to actually fulfill that purpose. The third 24 years is about sharing that, disseminating that with everybody else, bringing everybody, you know, letting everyone else benefit from that, you know, from whatever you've been able to do up to that point. And the last 24 years is about letting go of it all, right? And I look at our culture and it's like, we mistake a college major, a college degree for purpose, but it's not really purpose, right? We jump right into that acquisition phase, that second phase, and we stay there as long as we possibly can.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, even just like, I think about estimators in organizations and they have all this amazing knowledge. And then at some point they come to this crossroads of like, okay, I can hoard that and I have job security. I have certainty. I have control. Or I can share it freely with all these people, bring them up. Maybe some of them will be better than me. And they forget or they miss the point that like at that phase in their life, that is actually their value. Is to bring everybody else up. If they're holding on, if they're trying to hold on to the thing that they had, then they're actually missing an opportunity to grab something greater. It's like that, I don't know what they talk about, like the raccoon trap, right? Where they have the shiny object in the jar and they reach in there and they hold on to the shiny object and they can't get their fist out, right? And it's like, you're not willing to let go of the shiny object for their freedom, which is something much greater, right? Yeah. So I don't, you know, so I mean, again, we're going kind of off the deep end here, but.
Which is exactly where we wanted to go.
That importance of purpose, of authentic purpose, right, is something that, you know, we talk about this in the lean world. How can you possibly define waste if you don't know what value is, right?
Yeah.
You eliminate the wrong things.
I spent 15 years talking about Ono's waste. Till it became clear to me that if you can see value, waste just disappears on its own. It's like frost falling off your window. You know, when you get that first little piece and then you get like the glacial slide, that now the ice is coming out the window because you just pick that one little spot. It's very much like how, you know, our lives should be, should begin to unfold for us. And yet we still scrape just as hard on that stuff that's coming down, you know, that's easy because that's what we were told to do, right?
Yeah, I'm going to share an interesting just anecdote with you. I do these time studies with folks where like for a week, we actually like on an hourly basis, ask them to keep track of like how you spent your time. And we categorize it, you know, highest and best use, you know, moderate, whatever. And initially, I would work with them and say, okay, so how do we improve upon this? Like, you know, and we'd make tweaks here and tweaks there. You know what? That never really worked.
Right.
So we did the time. So I pivoted and we would do the time studies. And then I would say, okay, set that aside. Let's create your ideal schedule. What are the things that are most meaningful about your work? And let's figure out, you know, let's start with those. And let's figure out where you want to do them. And this is like almost like a leader standard work exercise. What are the daily? What are the weekly? What are the monthly things that you can hold yourself accountable for making sure you're doing these things that you've said are the most important things? And so when we do it from that perspective,
right.
It's amazing. They make drastic changes in their schedule. And so it's, I mean, it's just going back to what you were saying. When we focus on the waste first and foremost, it's hard. Like, you're only chipping away little bits here and little bits there. But if you focus on the value, if you get clear on value, then, you know, the entire sheet of ice comes off, right? And it's not a little chip here and a little chip there.
I think it's this kind of seminal fear that people have of giving up the rigidity that they've been held on to, because it's the one thing that leads them where they go. So Dan Fauché and I were facilitating something with the city of Riverside in California. And there was a conflict between these two departments, public works and something else. And they were always fighting over stuff, and they were always fighting over money, and they were always fighting over who was supposed to do what. Meanwhile, they had a mayor who would drive around, and every time the mayor would find a pothole, he would call in, and he would sit there until they came out and fixed the pothole. And they would go, well, how can we plan anything if this guy's out there and we have no idea where he's going to show up and where he's going to come? And I said, well, right down the street, you have a department where people come to work every day and they have no idea what they're going to do. Absolutely no idea what they're going to do, but they have to do it in the greatest way possible. It's the fire department. So I've said to people, think of just creating a fire department that just handles those things that you never expected. And don't worry about those things. Just wait till they happen. You have a fire department that takes care of that stuff. That's what we do, right? And then maybe that's very much like what you're talking about. When you devise your real schedule, you don't devise all the terrible things that are going to get in the way of.
Yeah. And I mean, it also brings up another thought of, like, you know, any type of person that's, you know, first responder or whatever, they have, you know, they have some basic skills that they practice over and over and over again, because they never know when they're going to need to use them, right? You don't want to learn on the fly some of this stuff.
Or which one's going to come up when, right?
Yeah. And actually, you know, the other part of that practice is so that whenever that emergency does come up, you have as many resources available to try to pay attention to what's really going on, not your preconceived notion about what should be going on, right? But that you can actually respond to the specifics and the nuance of the moment. You're actually most present. When you've got a plan in your head, you're not present. You're thinking about the plan, not taking inventory in terms of what's going on, right?
Yeah.
And even there, you know, that, like, so, you know, it's sort of a double whammy in our industry. We've got these scripted processes that we have to go through to deal with, you know, emergencies. So we don't have resources out there proactively, you know, dealing with them. And then when they come up, we've got to go through this administrative process to deal with them. And so it takes us even more out of being able to engage more intentionally, more fully, more, you know, authentically with that situation.
Yeah, right. There was a plane crash in Portland years ago, United Airlines plane crash. And the plane crashed not because of the buzzer that was going off, that everybody's trying to figure out why the buzzer was going off and they were reading the manuals and trying to find it. They ran out of gas because they spent all their time going through the manuals trying to figure out what was wrong with the plane rather than. And so they changed the way that they taught pilots how to do stuff. It became not a checklist and not a big manual, but it became much more about be aware, be understand what your surroundings are, what's happening. It's almost like the OODA loop, right? You orient yourself, you kind of get yourself, you know, understanding where you are and what your options are, and then you engage in that do part, and then you finally act on that.
Yeah.
There's just so many things that are wrong with the way that we develop processes that are, quote, standard, that it makes me crazy.
Yeah. And I mean, even something as simple as the RFI process, you know, again, if we go back to the purpose, what the purpose is supposed to be is that there's information that's needed for the people in the field to do their job that's missing or that's unclear. Right.
And that happens every single day. That need happens every single day on every single project anywhere in the world.
In every single life, it happens. I have a question. Something's unclear. I ask somebody, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, if I had to write it down on a piece of paper, send it to somebody, they figure out who to send it to, that it goes to that. it's like, I can't pause. Like, how am I going to cross the street?
I have a PowerPoint slide that has 19 different touches in the RFI process. And the one when it gets to the designer is see the plans. So it goes through 19 different iterations, costs us $1,000 in administrative time. And it was written by the lawyers. You know, you have 14 days to respond to an RFI. How crazy is that? I'm on a project for Humber College in outside of Toronto, where the mechanical and electrical team, they're from the same company, but they're different teams, obviously. They participated fully in the design. It's an IPD project. So they designed the system that they're installing, and they're seeing legendary productivity. Surprise, surprise. There's not a lot of questions because they answered all those questions in the design phase because they designed it. I mean, how cool is that?
Yeah, I mean, there's another interesting thing, you know, just going back to the RFI process. I was working with a project team, two different PEs, project engineers, lowest people on the totem pole, at least in the trailer, right? And again, we got clear, what's the process or what's the purpose of an RFI? The purpose is to make sure that the people that are doing the work have everything they need so that they can focus on that, right? And so if you're clear about that purpose, it actually frees up people to do that in whatever way is most aligned with their natural wiring, right? And so these two PEs, if you've had Rex on here before and he's talked about Clifton Strengths, you know, the Strength Finders stuff, they were wired very differently. And so one of them, more introverted, you know, academic, it's like, okay, so the best way, they want to dive into the specs, they want to dive into the drawings, they want to try to figure it out, run that idea past somebody, like that's their way. The other guy, not at all wired that way. He was all, you know, extroverted, relational, you know, all the top half of those quadrants.
Right.
And so his way of doing it might be different. It might be spending a lot of time out in the field, talking with the foreman, developing a rapport with them, asking them, hey, what do you got going on next week? Is there anything that you got questions about? Or, you know, that sort of thing. And so again, if you're clear about the purpose, it frees up a lot of people. You know, it frees up people to do things in a way that's actually more meaningful to them, that's more in line with their natural skills, their natural abilities, things that are energizing for them to do rather than draining for them to do. But you can't do that unless you've hit that purpose first, right? Unless you're clear about that purpose first.
Well, and unless the system is set up to allow discretion in how people respond to stuff.
Yeah.
So that the system is set up so that the information is more quickly available than not. And it really depends on what the priority in your system is. If the priority in your system is record keeping, then that's not going to happen. If the priority in your system is hierarchical, that you never get to, the PE in the trailer never gets to talk to the trade, because the PE has to talk to the assistant super, has to talk to the super, and the super talks to the foreman, and the foreman talks to, you know. All of those things happen in our business, and they were set up originally for some purpose. One purpose was maybe not to, you know, well, you don't have authority to cross contractual lines, so, you know, don't do it. But the way that we have developed processes and standard operating procedures are just themselves wasteful. So if you said to an owner, so would you like to pay every time there's a question on how to hang a difficult corner, how to do a 2-hour wall behind very tight ductwork, right? Do you want that? Do you want to pay $1,000 for that information to go back to the designers and have a written up response to it that you can put into a notebook someplace and give to a lawyer? Or do you want about a 15-cent response where the project architect and the project engineer are in the trailer and they're called out to the scene and you're looking at it with a flashlight going, oh yeah, sorry, buddy, but that duct's going to have to come down. Then you have to put the wall up and you're going to have to put the duct back. There's really no good way to do it unless you remove the framing on the other side and you do it backwards. And I go, oh, well, maybe we should redo. It's easier to redo the framing than it is to do that. So, I mean, that's what we don't do on our projects. And I think IPD, because it aligns people in one contract and everybody has the same interest, everybody has the same financial interest in solving that problem early, cheaply, and right, I think that helps us promote that, but that's still a system that people don't fully understand and don't leverage because they're used to their system and their culture.
Yeah.
All right. So let me ask you one last quick thing here. I've taken up an awful lot of your time and I really appreciate you hanging with me today. This has been fascinating. And we're going to have to continue this conversation over several bottles of wine. But we've talked a little bit about loneliness and faith. The other contradictions that you talked about in life, I think are really, really great. And I want you to expound on them just a bit. And you can do loneliness and faith as well if you want to, but urgency and equanimity and persistence and humility. So how do those fit into what we're trying to do in terms of rejigging our culture, getting our lives to be more intentional, allowing people to do their full purpose? I mean, there's a lot of people in the lean business that are taking respect for people and trying to do something with respect for people, but it's more about, well, you just have to be empathetic if they have to stay home with their kid, or let's make sure that we don't kill them. It's not like empowering them to enrich their soul through the power of work, which is something that I really believe in.
Yeah. And I mean, just before I get into those things, we see this on IPD teams. Sometimes the best way to show respect for people is to actually push people, you know, to push them, help them realize their potential. Yeah. It's not, oh, okay, you're having a tough time, let me take that from you. Like, that's not actually respect for the person.
Yeah.
That's infantilizing them, right?
I get violent when people talk about kumbaya. I said, there has never been anything kumbaya about building a building. It's hard. It's difficult. It takes a lot of focus and it takes great skill. And it is not for for the nervous or the, you know.
Yeah. We'll start with the, you know, the urgency and the equanimity. And, you know, I guess the way that I think about that, especially for, and these were all in context of this idea of a champion, someone who's trying, you know, striving for something that's better in the world, right? And trying to help others see that. And so the urgency part, you know, at least in my experience, is when you see that potential, it's really hard not to want it yesterday, right? And be frustrated with everybody else that they don't see it either. And so it's like, I'm trying to do all these things. I want to learn all these things. I want to try all these things. I want to, you know, like get other people excited about them. And again, I mean, you know, the existential part of that is it's like, I'm limited, like not just limited in my time. I mean, in a day, but my time in this life, it's like, I'm, you know, a year goes by and all of a sudden I'm, you know, not nearly as far down that road as I wanted to be. Right. So there's this urgency. There's this desire to, and I think where we get trapped there is we get caught up on outcomes that we were hoping for rather than intentionality, right? Like, what I mean by that is you may want to be able to do certain things. And there's a lot of that that's external that we don't have much control over. And so, you know, the part that we do have control over is us, like our individual part, right? And so sometimes that urgency can get amplified because we're not seeing the external results that we had hoped for. So that's one thing that has helped me temper that urgency a little bit is just like, okay, no, this is really about my growth and how I show up in these different situations. And so that I can work with. I can't control whether this owner decides to do an IPD project, or I can't control whether this organization effectively goes through their lean transformation the way that I want them to, right? Like, I can't control that fully. I can influence it, right? And so the reason the equanimity is the complement to that is because in that urgency, it's really easy to lose your ground. It's really easy to default to other people's priorities, to, you know, just get caught up with, like you said, like, you know, the whole place is on fire. Like, we got to do something. Let's run around like, you know, with our heads cut off for a little while. And then, you know, finally we can drop in to figure out what needs to happen. So that's where the equanimity comes in, is it's like, how do you hold your ground? How do you, in the midst of all that chaos, in the midst of all that urgency of, you know, those feeling, those strong feelings that you've got of wanting to be able to do something, but being limited as a human, being limited in terms of what you can actually do. Well, you got to take a couple breaths. You got to reconnect with what's most important to you. And then you can be much more discerning about where to actually put your effort and where to actually dedicate your time and use your creativity. Because as I said, it's just really easy. Like I've many times in my career, I've found myself doing what other people have asked for. And it's been subpar in terms of effectiveness, right? And so it almost goes back to, I don't know if this is a lean thing or not, but it's like, you know, in our culture, what we value is don't just stand there, do something, right? Like, being idle, being reflective, being stagnant for a moment is not valued, right? It's the busyness that's valued. The complement to that is don't just do something, sit there. Wait a second. Like, you could be busy and not impactful, or you can wait a second, check in and see what's really going on. And, you know, and be like that Kung Fu master, you know, the 80-year-old Kung Fu master with the two fingers, and he hits you right in the chest and you fly across the room because he knows exactly what to do and where to put the energy. And he gets the outcome, right? There's that potency, right? So that's that side, that urgency and the equanimity, right?
Yeah, that's where I have the hardest time because, you know, I'm a pretty proactive guy. Yeah. And when I see that the last planet system could save us from these crazy debacles, what I try to do is I try to, you know, the more I try to push it, the less response you get, you know, the further you get pushed away. It's a natural physical reaction. The greater the force, the greater the force in resistance.
The resistance, yeah.
And so what I try to do is I try to either manufacture a crisis where they have no alternative but to say, okay, let's try that. Or I just have to kind of stand my ground and just wait.
Yeah. So just wait patiently. So that other pair, I mean, fits in pretty well with that, Dick, you know, the persistence and the humility. And, you know, the persistence being, I know what needs to happen here. Like you said, like, you know, Last Planner would really solve the problem, right? And so how do I stay that course? And the course may not be, I need them to do the full Last Planner, you know, system. I need them to use it. It may be, I have to get them to understand that there's a better way to do this, right? And Last Planner textbook might not be the answer right away, right? So the humility is like, I know the goal is true, but the path might be different than what I thought it was. And so let me put my agenda aside. Let me put, you know, my own individual thoughts of like how this should go aside. Let me pay attention more closely to what's really going on. And then like, let me reevaluate that. Like I often say to folks, I said, the purpose, the intention, that should be held sacred. The means and methods can change. And so, you know, so that's that persistence and the humility is really persistence in that goal and that intention, that in fulfilling that purpose, but the humility in the path, because we just don't know, you know, how do you allow for the excitement of an unpredictability of life? You have to have humility that, oh, okay, that turned out differently. That was interesting. Rather than going into a shell and saying, oh, I'm never going to do that again. Well, that was interesting. What can we learn from it? What can we do different? You know?
Well, one of the things that that I think we try to promote with our simulations and the rest of that is self-learning, is that people come to aha moments, not because you tell them that this works, but because they have found that the way that they're doing it doesn't work. And they have to give people space to come to that moment and feel like they're not having to defend their life. I don't know if you ever saw the movie Albert Brooks Defending Your Life, where he goes to heaven and he has to defend himself. And he was like an insurance salesman. He never did anything really good. And Meryl Streep is up there, who ran back into her house to save her kittens. And you're going from one space in purgatory to another. And you're either on one bus or you go back and you have to relive it all and try it all over again. It's a very funny movie because Rip Torn is his lawyer, and then Buck Allen comes in as lawyer. It's very funny. But I always feel like when you put people on the spot where they have to defend what they're doing, they're going to fight harder for stuff that they don't even believe in. Unless you give them that opportunity to have a self aha moment, a self-teaching moment.
Yeah.
And maybe we have to be humble enough to know that we don't know everything about stuff. But, you know, if you're a passionate guy, it sounds like you know everything about everything. And clearly I'm passionate about stuff, but I certainly don't know everything about everything. I love to learn new stuff every day. And that's why it's been a joy, my friend, to have you on the podcast. So thanks very much for sharing your thoughts with us and your time. I know we've taken way more time than we thought we would, but I really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure, Dick. It's always a pleasure talking with you. And I appreciate the time, the opportunity.
Good to see you, man. We'll see you soon.
All right. Take care.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks for joining us. And tune in. I think our next episode is going to be Will Lichtig. We're trying to get him on the podcast. So always a great thing to have a pioneer and a thoughtful guy, just like Dr. Phelps. Adios, everybody.
Thank you for tuning in to the Lean Construction Blogs podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please help us spread the word by sharing, subscribing, or leaving a review on your preferred podcast listening platform. Remember to join us next time as we continue to lower the barriers to applying lean construction and help take your lean journey to the next level. And don't forget to visit the Lean Construction blog to stay up to date on our latest podcast episodes, weekly blog posts, monthly webinars, and upcoming conferences. We hope to see you on the next episode.